Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments. Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, February 27th. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Shartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Joining us today on Medical Monday, Dr. Nina Sachs of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. She is here to respond to your questions and comments on all things involving the gastrointestinal tract and ailments involving these parts of the body. It'll be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Dr. Nina Sachs is here, and your calls coming up right after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and Dr. Nina Sachs joins us today to respond to your questions and comments on gastroenterology. She comes to us from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants in Albany, New York. Dr. Sachs received her medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and completed her internal medicine internship and residency at Strong Memorial Hospital. Dr. Sachs completed her gastroenterology fellowship at Albany Medical College. She is a board member of St. Peter's Surgery and Endoscopy Center. Dr. Nina Sachs, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to the program, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. We try to get to as many emails as we can. Obviously, if you get them in early, you got a better shot. Phone calls take precedence here on this call-in show, 800-348-2551. So, Dr. Sachs, March, a special month.
Yes, March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. We'd like to talk about perhaps screening for colon cancer.
This is the time to talk about it.
Yes, exactly.
How have the techniques changed over the years?
Well, there's still colonoscopy.
Right.
And if you think that the preparation has gotten easier,
no,
it has not.
There's no blood test that is reliable at this point?
Well, there are stool tests. There's a stool for DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are stools for occult blood, hidden blood. There's stools for immunologic markers of blood. So there are other tests, alternatives. The stool DNA test is really interesting. It's really, these are screening tests. So these are not for patients who have a family history of colon cancer or who have had polyps. These are average risk individuals. And the stool DNA test is covered by Medicare, but I'll have to be honest, we're having some issues with insurances, other insurances, in covering this test. It costs about $500.
Yikes.
The person collects their stool, puts it in a cylinder, and it's sent to a commercial lab for DNA analysis. If it shows certain markers that large polyps or colon cancer produce, then that would be a person who would want to go on
follow
to colonoscopy.
Up. Am I out of my mind, or are they actually advertising the mail-in on TV?
Yes, they are advertising it, which makes me, again, smile a little bit because I'm thinking, okay, but is it going to be covered? Okay. And then how long is it good for? Some literature would say 3 years, some 5 years. You know, a good screening colonoscopy with an excellent preparation is approximately an every 10-year test mm-hmm. in an average-risk person. You know, assuming the test was negative.
Average risk being no family history.
No family history of colon cancer or polyps. It's not a symptom-related test. It's a screening test.
Mm-hmm.
And no polyps found on the first colonoscopy.
Dr. Nina Sachs is our guest. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. Greg in Bennington, Vermont. Greg, you're first.
Hi there. I have anemia due to blood loss. And mild hemorrhoids was the first thought of the cause. I was wondering what the prognosis for getting that fixed is, as well as what other diagnostics to identify possible blood losses.
May I ask, what tests have you had done?
Just the blood test that had the anemia.
Okay, and have you seen blood from these hemorrhoids?
Yeah, occasionally there'll be a drip.
And was it a severe anemia or?
Not at the time. I wasn't aware of symptoms, but since then, I think I've become more aware of them.
Okay, so what I would say is, yes, hemorrhoids is a possibility, but iron deficiency anemia could be from chronic blood loss from a number of sites, anywhere in the GI tract, from the esophagus, stomach, small intestine, or colon. Are we sure it's an iron deficiency anemia?
Blood loss anemia.
Yeah, okay, so that's okay. Iron deficiency. So typically, you really can't say definitely hemorrhoids until you've done an evaluation. And typically that would include a colonoscopy, also an upper endoscopy, an upper GI scope. And sometimes we can even, you swallow a capsule and we can look at the small intestine as well.
What's in the capsule?
The capsule is, actually photographs the entire small bowel. It runs through the small bowel.
You're kidding
me.
And
you read it on the computer. So it's a computer-generated image of the small intestine. So if you're looking, you could have small little blood vessels in the small bowel that could be bleeding. Sometimes if you take Motrin, Nuprin, Advil, Aleve, those types of medicines, you could have little sites of GI blood loss throughout the GI tract. So it's another way to look at areas that are not that easy to look at with a scope.
This is fascinating. And how much does a capsule camera cost?
Several hundred dollars. But those for this should be covered by most insurances if the workup has been proper. You know, a negative upper endoscopy, negative colonoscopy, and still with the anemia.
So it transfers the telemetry, the data, via radio waves to a receiver in your office? How does it work?
It's computer generated, actually.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Anita and Clinton, you're on with Dr. Nina Sachs.
Hi, Dr. Sachs. I'm 67, female, and had a long spell of nausea and tried eliminating different things from my diet. And then one day just decided to try a plant enzyme with seven different enzymes in it, and the nausea stopped immediately. So I wonder if you could tell me what is going on, and does that mean that something's not functioning up to par?
I think nausea is one of the most subjective. It's such a subjective complaint that what we would call the differential diagnosis, or what we go through to try to figure it out, is really wide ranging. So it's hard for me to understand. A plant-based enzyme, would that be like a pancreatic enzyme? Is that what you were?
It's seven different enzymes, protease, amylase, lipase, cellulase,
lactase. Yeah, so those are pancreatic enzymes, and the pancreas does secrete enzymes to help us digest our food. I must tell you that pancreatic insufficiency, or something that would get better with enzymes in terms of nausea, it's not very common, but if it works, it's certainly not going to hurt you. It's just, you know, nausea can be ulcers, nausea could be reaction to different foods. So basically what you're doing is kind of helping your general digestion, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. And does that mean that the pancreas is not working efficiently, or
no? I don't think so.
Might be problems down the road.
I don't think so. I really don't.
Okay.
I don't have anything to go with, you know, with what you've said. I don't think so.
Well, Anita, thank you for the call. Our number here on this Medical Monday is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
I was watching a program on Richard III, and they said he had scoliosis and roundworms. I was wondering if you're still seeing nematode parasites such as Ancylostoma, Toxocara, or Trichuris in your practice?
You know, in my practice, you know, occasionally we have patients with these issues, but just not very often in where the location where I practice.
All right. Hey, Jim, I got to say, every week you have an interesting question. I don't know whether you have a big book and you come up with them, but they're always impressive, and we thank you for that, my friend. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. All right, let's get one more call in before the first break. Nina Sachs is our guest. Gary, in West Springfield, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Hi. I'm a 76-year-old male. A couple of years ago, I had a colonoscopy. Everything was okay. At the time the doctor did that test where they go down your throat, I have a GERD and also a hiatal hernia. Mm-hmm. He found some scarring on my esophagus, which he was concerned about. He put me on a Prilosec drug. I took it for over a year. I read the literature that came with the when I get my medication, and they say most people should stay on this drug only for 3 or 4 weeks because of damage to the kidneys and also how it affects your bones. I've been taking the drug for a year. I went back to see my doctor, told him I was not crazy about taking the drug, and he put me on Zantac. I'm supposed to go to see him next week, and I'm wondering what your opinion is on what I should do.
Okay, so this is a great question. So the Prilosec is what's called a proton pump inhibitor, and that's a very potent acid reducer for stomach acid. And when you have inflammation of the esophagus, that really comes from reflux of acid, most times from the stomach. So by neutralizing acid, you're going to heal that esophagus, okay?
Yes.
And there are many people who, when you try to then taper them off the Prilosec or Prilosec-like drug, they will have symptoms. They'll have acid reflux symptoms, or they can't swallow, or issues. For those patients, what I generally say is we want to reduce the medicine to the lowest possible dose, okay, to minimize any risk of long-term use. The articles regarding kidney issues, regarding bone demineralization, regarding Alzheimer's. There have been many, you know, recently, little bits and pieces of articles about possible risks of these medicines long term. But I will tell you, reading over these articles, for instance, the article about Alzheimer's, it was a poorly crafted study.
Oh, interesting.
I don't really think the answer is in yet. But what I've noticed is, you know, the media picks up on it, and then you see it over and
sure,
over
it's
and
a sound
over.
Bite.
And so all my patients are coming in and saying, well, do I really need it? I think that's a good thing, because you should analyze, does your patient still really need it? Are they having symptoms? So what I generally try to do is after, you know, 8 to 12 weeks, particularly with esophageal issues, because those take a few weeks to heal, you try to taper the medicine.
Hmm.
You don't want to stop it suddenly, because you get a rebound of acid. So if you stop the Prilosec suddenly, your symptoms will come back. So you don't want to do that. But I would have a discussion. Number one, why are you being treated? And what's the lowest possible dose of medicine to control your symptoms?
Dr. Nina Sachs is our guest on this Medical Monday. Our number is 800-348-2551, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Union College Concert Series, presenting the Doric String Quartet. The British Quartet performs works by Haydn and Bartok with Schubert's late G major quartet, Friday, March 10th at 7:30 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. The 1850 House and Tavern offering their romance package featuring champagne and chocolate, the 1850house.com or 845-658-7800 for details. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, opening March 4th, with the exhibition Animals in Bronze from the Georgia Museum of Art and Canada Lake Portraits by Paul Bransom, arkellmuseum.org. New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com. And from Nathan LaTower Hospital, announcing the opening of a new dialysis center in Gloversville for renal kidney care. NLH.org.
It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok today. Dr. Nina Sachs is here. We talk gastroenterology. And before we get back to the phones at 800-348-2551, Nina, we'll do a couple of quick emails here. This one is from Mark. It is very frightening to hear of a person developing appendicitis. Do we know yet what causes appendicitis? What is it? Why does it happen to some people and not others? And has any progress been made on prevention?
Good question. We used to think it has to do with fecal material getting caught in the appendix. And we now know it has to do with immunity and inflammation, like diverticulitis.
Yeah.
But no one really knows. And it's not exactly hereditary, unless, you know, it's caused by a blockage from a small cancer or carcinoid tumor.
Yeah.
So
we're not sure.
Not sure.
Do we even know what the appendix is supposed to do?
Well, we used to think it did nothing, that it was a vestigial organ.
Yeah.
But now we feel it does have something to do with immunity. Because, you know, there's all kinds of interesting research being done on the microbiome, the bacteria of the gut, and immunity. And the appendix does have something to do with that and probably does have a function. For instance, sometimes Crohn's disease, which is felt to be some altered immunity leading to inflammation of the small bowel and colon, can occur after appendectomy. That can affect it. So it is now felt that it does have a role.
Interesting. Well, that's a shame. I lost mine about 20 years
ago.
I had a burst appendix. It was awful. I was in the hospital 10 days.
And we live normally. Okay, it's like we can live without a gallbladder. You can live without an appendix. But it's an interesting area, the whole microbiome and bacteria.
The whole business of appendicitis, though, like I had it, and then a year later I got it again. And I was sure that it wasn't appendicitis because I was told you can't get it twice.
No, actually, there is an entity called chronic appendicitis, so you can. And there is some literature, particularly in the pediatric population, that sometimes you can get away with antibiotics and not take the appendix out. So the whole area is interesting and actually a little ripe for research, I would say.
Splendid. Yeah. Well, let's get back to the phones. Nina Sachs is our guest, 800-348-2551. Who's been waiting longest? Oh, Richard in Niskayuna. Richard, you're on.
Hi. I've been told that when you get older, I'm saying 75 or 80 maybe, the wall of your intestines become quite fragile and becomes dangerous to have a colonoscopy because you might be perforated and end up with a colostomy, I guess it's called, a bag.
The issue of when to stop screening colonoscopy. I mean, when do you stop? You know, certainly if you have symptoms as an older person, bleeding, iron deficiency, anemia, then, you know, you may need to have a colonoscopy done. And certainly the preparation and the procedure and the medication can have slightly more risk in an elderly population. That being said, I have patients who are 75 that do beautifully with colonoscopy and others that are 65 that I wouldn't do it because they have so many medical issues.
Yes.
So I really definitely look at each patient, okay? There is literature that in the very elderly, you know, 85 and up, there may be some increased risk with the procedure. For screening, meaning just doing a colonoscopy to screen for colon cancer, the current recommendations do not call for screening after age 75, but we don't always follow that. I try to individualize based on the patient's desire and their overall health.
Richard, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. Dr. Nina Sachs is our guest, and Ron in Esopus. Ron.
Hey, Ray. Hey, Dr. Sachs. Thank you for taking the call. I've had this like serious post-nasal drip for over a year, I'd say. I've been to an ENT. He scoped me a couple of times, didn't see anything. But I read about this thing called airway reflux. And I'm wondering if it could be something like that. Can you tell me what that's about?
I think what you're referring to is laryngopharyngeal reflux. So atypical causes of acid reflux or acid from the stomach into the esophagus actually causing laryngitis or postnasal drip or sinusitis. However, typically, if that's the issue, then the ear, nose, and throat doctor, when they do an indirect laryngoscopy, should see some swelling and redness at the vocal cords, which so it shouldn't be a normal exam. if they do, then that can be looked at by someone like me, and we might prescribe something like Prilosec that we've been talking about to, as a trial to see if that would be helpful. I should tell you, there are other so many other causes of postnasal drip as well, allergies and seasonal issues as well. So it's a difficult area, but there should be a change on the indirect laryngoscopy.
Well, Ron, thank you very much for that call. Boy, the lines are loaded. Dr. Nina Sachs is our guest. 800-348-2551, the number. Steve and Canaan. Steve, you're next.
Hi. Listen, I wanted to follow up on this Prilosec business.
Sure.
I was prescribed that after I had a stomach bleeding incident. I'm on a blood thinner, so it made it a little more critical. Now, I never had acid reflux or heartburn or anything like that, but they prescribed this as a preventive.
Well, let me ask you, can I just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want, what did they find when they scoped you that was a source of your bleeding? Was it an ulcer or erosions, or what did they find?
So it was, Jesus, they had to patch it up. So it was some kind of wound or perforation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a perforation, I don't think, I mean, that would be a, they would have to fix that with a major surgery. You didn't have major surgery. You just had an upper scope?
And endoscope, yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like what may have, you may have had an ulcer. I'm going to guess that, all right, that you may have had an ulcer and you're on a blood thinner chronically, correct?
Right.
So what they, what this medicine is very good at is what we call cytoprotection, okay? So we're protecting the stomach lining in a person who's on a blood thinner, so would be at some increased risk of bleeding, okay? And there is literature with certain of the blood thinners, particularly some of these new novel oral anticoagulants like Eliquis and Brilinta, some of these new ones who that are beautiful for the heart but not so good for the GI tract, that staying on a medicine of this type may help prevent rebleeding. So that's something you should actually speak to your gastroenterologist about and your cardiologist. It's kind of what we would call cardio-GI now. It's a whole kind of integration. So which medicine should you be on? How long are you on the blood thinner and for what purpose? And before stopping the Prilosec, I would definitely talk to your GI.
In your practice, do you often coordinate with cardiologists?
Absolutely. Now, especially in this day and age, because of cardiac stents and the need for these blood thinners. So, absolutely. Let's say I'm going to do a colonoscopy. I want to stop the patient's Plavix for a week before, because I have to take a polyp out. You have to weigh the risk of post-polypectomy bleeding versus the risk that they're going to be off their blood thinner. It's complicated. I always get the cardiologist involved.
Is coordinating with other doctors easier now than, say, 15, 20 years ago?
I used to like the old telephone. But I think it's fine. It's fine as long as you take the time to do it.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Nina Sachs is our guest, 800-348-2551. Kathy in Clifton Park, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Of course.
My question is also about reducing or taking the PPIs and weaning yourself off them.
Yes.
I take omeprazole.
Yes.
And I was wanting to get off it, and I was wondering if I could, like, go every other day.
Yeah.
You know, then maybe every third day.
Yes. How much are you taking? 40 milligrams?
Yes.
And what are you taking it for, if I may ask?
Acid reflux.
So acid reflux. All right. So remember I said you don't want to stop something quickly? But if you're taking 40 milligrams, your doctor might be able to just say, okay, let's try 20 milligrams. And you do 20 milligrams for a month. And then you're doing well with that, no symptoms. You may do 20 every other day. Or you may switch at that point to what's called an H2 blocker, like ranitidine or Pepcid, which doesn't have the same side effects as the proton pump inhibitor, but also is not quite as effective for acid reflux symptoms. It also depends on, did you have esophagitis at presentation? What did it look like? Was your esophagus normal? So your own gastroenterologist or physician would be in a good position to help you with that taper. Okay?
Okay. And I have a follow-up with that.
Sure.
could you speak about any natural remedies for acid reflux?
Yes,
for
there's apple cider vinegar. Have you tried that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, apple cider vinegar is a good...
For reflux?
For acid
That's
reflux
counterintuitive,
symptoms.
It's, it would seem.
It works. It's really... It works. My patients tell me.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. So apple cider vinegar, you have to take enough of it. It's online. It's online, the dose. Some people swear by some of these new IBS meds, which have a little peppermint. But peppermint, I think, to me is counterintuitive because I've always felt peppermint caused more reflux. Ginger may be helpful. So there are other mm-hmm. things. But I just want to make sure I'm not having you take apple cider vinegar if you have esophagitis. You know, so you really want to get your doctor involved, okay?
Kathy, thank you so much for the call. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. Nina Sachs is our guest. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. And Kate in Northampton. Kate, you're on.
Hello?
Kate? Did we lose Kate? Maybe.
Are you trying for Denise?
Well, it says Kate, but I'll call you Denise. Hello, Denise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
How are you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Appreciate it. Well, all of a sudden, I realized I couldn't hear anything else. So, I just have a question. About a year and a half ago, I had a ruptured appendix that went misdiagnosed for a number of days, and I ended up with major abdominal surgery. And I need to have a colonoscopy because over five years ago, I had a polyp removed.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I should be concerned about or should be alerting?
Okay, so what does major abdominal surgery mean?
Oh, okay, so it was a ruptured appendix, and they tried to, basically, they flipped me right down the middle.
Yeah, so you had a laparotomy, and they took out the appendix and anything else? Just the appendix?
It wasn't laparoscopic. It wasn't.
I know. I said a laparotomy.
Oh.
That's an open surgery.
What it's called?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And they took out your appendix only. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So they took out your appendix. You didn't have to have a colostomy. They didn't take your bowel out.
No.
Just all right.
No, nothing. No.
Okay. And when was that done?
In 2015, a year and a half ago.
Okay. It should be fine to have your colonoscopy.
Okay.
You could tell your gastroenterologist just exactly, you know, that you had an appendectomy, that you had a surgery for that. Certainly, there could be some scar tissue, but with care, I'm a good gastroenterologist could perform a colonoscopy and do an excellent job.
Fair enough.
All right.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
you're welcome.
Kate. We appreciate it. It's Medical Monday, Gastroenterology Today with Dr. Nina Sachs, and the number is 800-348-2551. Nancy in Greenwich. Nancy, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Sachs.
Hi.
And Ray, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask a question about any updated new research related to Lynch syndrome. I've had had several cases of various types of cancer as a result of Lynch syndrome, the MSH2 genetic mutation. And I wonder if there's any new research, especially related to prevention, such as whether aspirin is effective or any dietary preventative.
Time out just a second. Give us a quick definition of what Lynch syndrome is.
Lynch syndrome is familial, polyposis hereditary colon cancer. So what that means is it's a genetic condition in families such as the caller where there are certain risks. So colon cancer, colon polyps, but also in some cases stomach polyps, polyps around where the bile duct comes into the small intestine, near the ampulla vater, it's called. There also is an increased incidence of cancer of the ureter, which is the urinary collecting system.
Mm-hmm.
Also in women, some GYN cancers. So it's a pretty serious condition and requires a lot of testing and pre-testing, colonoscopy, endoscopy, urine cytology, all kinds of things to kind of hopefully prevent development of cancer. And even though you have those tests, patients still can get cancer. So the question was about prevention of polyps. Is that what you're asking me?
Well, I'd just like to know if there's any new research. I'm familiar with the Amsterdam Protocol.
Yeah, and, there are new markers, you know, for other Lynch syndrome variants. So there's genetic research going on. But as far as preventive, aspirin, calcium, I'm not aware of, you know, new research in terms of prevention of polyps. Is your family, are you all enrolled in screening programs?
Most of us are. Not all my, you know, not everybody.
But it's good that you know. It's good that you know, because you know to have these, your colonoscopies done frequently. So that's good that you know. I think the interesting thing, some of the interesting aspects of this are also other variants. So we're finding it more and more.
Mm.
You know,
finding it more and more. It's more becoming more and more diagnosed. More.
Yeah,
frequently.
I think we're better at it. You know, we're looking for it, and we're better at diagnosing. Yeah.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for that call.
Thank you very much.
Nina Sachs is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551, and we'll take a short break. Be right back.
Support comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Guilderland, 518-432-0358. Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale retail shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington. JaneIredale.com. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz presents The Shadow of a Gunman, a comic tragedy from Sean O'Casey's Dublin Trilogy, March 2nd through 12th, Parker Theater, newpaltz.edu/theater. Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement. A proud supporter of public radio, forthillautobody.com. And from Careers in Transition LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com.
Hello again. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff here, 2:40 on your Monday afternoon. Our guest today on this Medical Monday is Dr. Nina Sachs, and the number is 800-348-2551. Good luck getting through it this time. The lines are loaded. We'll do a couple of quick emails here, Nina, and then back to the phones. Here's one from Jim in Mountainville with things I can't pronounce, but I'll try it all the same. I'm a 65-year-old. I'm a 65-year-old woman who was diagnosed with stage A esophagitis 2 years ago after a manometry, 24-hour pH test and several endoscopies. It was decided that GERD was not the cause, yet my doctor wants me to continue with a high-dose PPI, probably for the rest of my life. Are there other causes of esophagitis other than GERD? Are there other procedures or tests that can further diagnose the possible cause of my esophagitis? And that's from Jill.
Okay. So, Jill, I would say that, you know, you talked about some tests that look at reflux of acid and other things from the stomach into the esophagus. And assuming all those tests were negative, sometimes nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can cause esophagitis.
What is esophagitis?
Esophagitis are little ulcerations in the esophagus, right where the stomach and esophagus meet typically.
Okay.
And she said she had grade A, so that's minor. Mm-hmm. One question I would ask is, no matter what the cause was when you were first diagnosed, do you still have esophagitis? Because if it may be that it healed and you could taper off of the medicine. So it's unclear to me from your email why it is that your physician wants you to stay on it for life. You know, I probably don't have enough information to
right.
give you a good answer.
Life, so, theoretically, is a long time.
Yeah. So I would think that I would ask your physician why he feels that way. What was it about your endoscopy and your findings that make him feel that way? And get a better explanation.
Now, the second part of Jill's question was, are there other procedures or tests that can further diagnose the possible cause of esophagitis?
Well, it sounds like you've had, you've had the manometry, which shows how your motion of the esophagus is.
The 24-hour pH.
You've had the pH test that looks at. Now, I don't know what kind of pH test you had. There is a second-generation pH test that looks for base reflux in addition to acid, and caraffate may help that. So there are other issues. I think you should try to hone it down with your gastroenterologist.
Follow up a little bit.
Absolutely.
All right, this one is from Francis and Adams. I eat a lot of hot chili peppers. I like the flavor, and they're great for regularity. Well, thank you, Francis. I'd like to know if there's anything harmful in doing this.
No.
All right, fair enough. Simple. Let's go back to the phones then. 800-348-2551.
I like them too.
Lisa in Argyle is on. Lisa, you're on with Nina Sachs.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My mother was diagnosed with a diverticuli in her esophagus, and it's like a zanker or something.
Uh-huh.
Basically, she's been getting sort of progressively worse. She chokes all the time, and food comes back up, liquid comes back up, tons of gurgling. And they kind of told her there's nothing she can do.
Okay, how old is your mother?
She's 69, and she's in perfect health.
Okay, and she has what is called a Zanker's diverticulum. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So a Zanker's diverticulum is an outpouching in the upper esophagus, okay? It has to do probably with the muscle of the between the pharynx and the esophagus, called the upper esophageal sphincter. We've been talking a lot about reflux esophagitis,
yeah,
which typically is has to do with more the lower esophageal sphincter, but there's an upper sphincter, and sometimes there's some spasm of that upper sphincter, and you can get an outpouching at that area, like a diverticulum or an outpouching, and it can catch food and liquid, and that's called the Zanker's diverticulum. It's not true that there's nothing you can do. Has she seen a gastroenterologist?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She had an endoscopy and a couple Varium, you know, then, like,
Where do you guys live?
Argyle.
Where's that?
Well, she lives in Cambridge. She goes
okay.
to Glens Falls Hospital.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say she needs to talk to them again. It's not true that there's nothing you can do. You can, there's a surgery called a cricopharyngeal myotomy where you can open that area and remove that Zanker's if the problem is bad enough. I wouldn't do that for all patients,
yeah,
but a good thoracic surgeon can do that. And there's also some centers, not that I'm aware of locally, but some centers where this could be done laparoscopically also by a competent thoracic surgeon, and some larger academic GI centers.
Mm.
So nothing that you can do doesn't sound right to me, so I would get another opinion. Get another opinion.
Lisa, thank you so much for that. And over to Jim in Adams, Mass. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Ray. Hi. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Hey, Ray. Are you there?
No, yeah,
oh, yeah,
we're here.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Sachs, glad to hear you back on the radio again.
Thank you.
And who would have thought when you started in your specialty that we would have found so many things are so vitally connected to the entire digestive system, from our immune system to even to our moods and thoughts can be affected by them, they say, if we have the proper gut bacteria going for us.
Absolutely.
And I just turned 74. I've had several colonoscopies, and I intend to continue on with them as long as I can have them. And they're great because they do detect a few polyps. Our mother had diverticulitis or losis, I forget which it was. And later years, she also had leaky bowel, which she had to have repaired surgery. And then now just 2 years back now, my younger brother, 5 years younger than me, developed the same condition, leaky bowel syndrome.
Do you have a question?
He's really gotten his diet straightened around where he's getting enough fiber in his diet, to tell you the truth.
Hey, Jim, you got a question for Dr. Sachs?
No, I'm just telling these people out there, don't fear colonoscopies. They're your friend. They're your lifesaver.
Good.
Well,
excellent.
Thanks, man. We
Thank
appreciate
you.
That call. So this business about your intestines affecting your moods, what is all that about?
Well, what is that about? It's now felt that the bacteria in the gut can affect your weight. Okay, there is some indication that perhaps depression may be related in some ways to your gut flora. Ah. But these are just, this is a whole frontier of new research.
Because okay. I know when I get indigestion, I'm in kind of a bad mood.
But think about the gut. The gut is the most primitive organ. And there's an entity called irritable bowel syndrome.
Sure.
Where gut doesn't work right, diarrhea, constipation, bloating. And there is an association between these symptoms and in people with depression and anxiety. Ah. So there is a connection. It's called the brain-to-gut connection.
Nina Sachs is our guest, and Liz in New Paltz is next. Liz.
Hi. Michael. My mom is calling in 8 years ago. She was treated. She had surgery, and she had follow-up colonoscopies for years afterwards. Now, her father died of colon cancer in 1977, and one of her brothers died of colon cancer in 1992, and her doctor told her 2 years ago that she no longer needed to have colonoscopies, and she, of course, was happy, but my sister and I are concerned because she already had colon cancer, and they also told my sister, had her ask her doctor about getting the screening to see if it was something genetic that my sister and I would need to worry about, and her doctor told her no, she didn't need to do that.
Okay, so you have several first-degree relatives, so your mother and a few siblings who've had colon cancer in that family?
Yeah, but my mom, her father, and one of her brothers.
Yeah, you should be checked for that. Remember we were talking about that Lynch syndrome, if you were listening earlier?
Yeah,
it would be important. Okay, because you've got three relatives. So there are several, at least here, I know the local oncology groups do genetic counseling and appropriate blood work to look for Lynch syndrome. And I think that you would qualify.
Okay.
I do. And I think the age is relative. Okay. If a person is healthy and it's something that they want to do, you know, I would work with the patient. But I think 88, you're getting up there. So you have to understand that there's more risk. So it's risk-benefit alternative. Okay?
Well, thank you for that call. And, boy, I tell you, we have so many calls here. Let's go to Dick in Longmeadow. Dick, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm just kind of curious. It's more of a general question. You know, with the advent of H2 antagonists and proton pump inhibitors, mm-hmm. has that caused a reduction because more people are being treated in Zollinger-Ellison syndrome?
Yes, I think we may not pick it up, okay?
What is that?
Zollinger-Ellison syndrome is a disease where there's a very high hyperacidity. It comes from little tumors, which is a complex syndrome. Mm-hmm. But it used to present with multiple duodenal ulcers and because you have such a high acid content. But now I think we're picking it up if it's severe, but we're probably not picking it up as often because of proton pump inhibitors, because of the acid reduction. I think you're absolutely right.
Just curious. Thank you for
it's a good question. Yeah.
Thanks, Dick. We appreciate it. And Barbara in Boston Spa is next. Barbara, you're on with Dr. Nina Sachs.
Hi. I had about 15 years ago, I had one of those hydrogen breath tests and developed acid reflux that everyone seems to have. And I was on Acifex for a long time. And then it was suggested that perhaps it was too long and get off of it. So then I was given a suggestion of just trying Tums for a while. Well, that didn't really work much. And my concern is I am now on just Tegament. Mm-hmm. I don't know how. It's fairly new for me. I have a different doctor. I guess my concern is it's not working 100%, but I'm also, since I've been on it, have quite a few bowel movements. I mean, they're not diarrhea, but
Let me make a suggestion to you. Tegament may not be the right medication. And since I don't know what your original, whether it was severe esophagitis or just reflux without findings at endoscopy, I would ask you to speak to your physician about, options for anti-acid treatment. There are some patients who do require proton pump inhibitors long-term because of their symptoms and what the findings were. So it's hard for me to individualize.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you very much. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And now we go over to Liz in Boston Spa. Liz.
Oh, hi. My question is 6 years ago, I had laryngeal, stage four laryngeal cancer, which was luckily successfully treated at Mass General. And as part of going through that, I also had a feeding tube inserted,
sure,
and they stapled my stomach to my abdominal wall. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've had, significant GERD. I'm on, omeprazole plus mm-hmm. two ranitidines a day. And recently I had some exacerbation of the GERD, and they decided to do an endoscopy, and they couldn't get the scope down because my esophagus was constricted. Now, occasionally I have problems swallowing pills, but normally I can, eat everything, et cetera. I assume this constriction is due to radiation damage because I got a lot of radiation on my neck.
So you had surgery and radiation, or just radiation?
No, just I had chemo radiation.
Chemo and radiation.
It
probably is. Did they try using a pediatric endoscope?
Yes, they did. I asked the GI doctor, did you try a pediatric? And she said yes. And they did send me for, the barium thing.
I was just going to ask you that,
They didn't seem to say anything for that. Now, when I went through the whole treatment, they were very cognizant of my swallowing ability because that was the risk that I was going to lose swallowing ability. And, I had swallowing tests with barium and stuff, and I'm wondering if I should go back to Boston and
have that done again. If they couldn't pass the scope, it doesn't make sense that your esophagram or your barium study would be normal. Okay, so I'm missing a piece here. I would tell you also, when you've had radiation, it does impair the saliva formation in the mouth. And so there's you.
Oh, yes. I spend all night with a vaporizer next
to
me.
Right. So the significance of that is if you do get acid reflux, you're not neutralizing it as well with your with saliva, which can neutralize acid. So people in your situation do often have reflux chronically, pretty severe. So it's not unusual. I would say your thought about going back to Boston, it sounds like a good thought to me.
All right. Liz, thank you so much for the call. Our guest today is Dr. Nina Sachs. Oh, we have about time for maybe one or two more here. So let's go to Anne in Voorheesville. Anne.
Hi, Dr. Sachs.
Hi.
My husband had surgery in December to remove a giant colonic diverticula.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, he's had blood in his stool, and in January, he had a colonoscopy, and the doctor used cautery at the anastomosis,
mm-hmm.
but the bleeding has continued on and off.
Okay.
So he's anemic at this point and is receiving IV iron now.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to test for occult blood, how long does he have to be off the IV iron in order to not get a false positive? And what's the next logical step to try to stop the bleeding?
Yeah. Does he have scar tissue where they hooked him up? Is that what they think is bleeding?
I the surgeon didn't tell us that. I just know that the anastomosis was where he...
Okay, so the connection.
Know.
So, number one, IV iron does not affect a stool hemocult. Okay? So you don't have to worry about that, all right? I would say if, here I'm going to postulate because I'm not exactly sure what's going on here, but if there's a problem at the connection and there's some scar tissue there, you could do laser, ablation with a colonoscope and laser this, or use argon coagulation, other techniques to get rid of this tissue. So I don't know where he's being treated. I don't know who your GI people are, but there are other things. There are other options.
And thank you. And I guess we have time for maybe one more here and about a minute or so to go with Jessica in Kingston. Jessica, you're on.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I've had anemia. I've been diagnosed with anemia, severe anemia, probably four or five times over the last 20 years. I had a colonoscopy 2 years ago. My mom had a history of polyps. She had a few colonoscopies. Her father died of colon cancer. My colonoscopy was perfect. The doctor said I was clean. Everything was good. That wasn't the cause of anemia. He did recommend an upper endoscopy, which I didn't do because I didn't think I had any related symptoms. But I happened to tune into the program earlier today when you were talking about some other possible things to look for. So I was wondering if you could give me a little info.
Yeah, if this is iron deficiency anemia, you didn't tell me what type of, but if it is, celiac disease could do that because you don't absorb iron. You may have an iron malabsorption, and endoscopy is critical because you could biopsy the small bowel and look for that, and also look for upper GI bleeding sites. You may need a capsule endoscopy, so like we were talking about before. Sorry I had to rush.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry to rush you along, but Dr. Nina Sachs, we had so many calls. Great job today.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Support for Medical Monday comes from New York Oncology Hematology, a team of 30 physicians providing personalized treatment plans for cancer and blood disorders. World-class care, close to home, NewYorkOncology.com. Thanks again to the great Dr. Nina Sachs for being here. Thanks again to the great Dr. Zachary Malloy, who is at the controls today. Oh, congratulations on your PhD, Zach. Well done. Joe Makowitz answered the calls today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, I don't know what's on tomorrow on Vox Pop. I didn't even check. It's not on the script. But if you tune in around 2, something good may or may not happen.